Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why? Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, May 16th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered in my 48 years of doing therapy. These tools are available absolutely free, which is hard to believe, but through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice, all you have to do is go to the website at whyagain.org, click on the link that says Start Here in the upper left-hand corner, and it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on it, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, where people have been stepped through that worksheet process or provided powerful testimonials about how the use of that process has improved the quality of their lives and relationships. And repeated listening to those audio files can serve as a tutorial for this work. If you don't have the access to a Mind Shifter support group, or if you can't listen to this show live, those files are available as a resource. And anyone can learn to use these tools and grow in their skill of applying them to their lives just by listening to those archived files and applying the worksheet process in their own life. And as I like to say, we appreciate it when people do that soon and often, because it frequently leads to comments and questions, sometimes testimonials, sometimes answers. And if you have any of those, you can email us, tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org, whyagain.org. And if we get an email question or comment from you, we will address it during the radio show, and as time allows, we will then email you and let you know what day and time your comment or question or testimonial was discussed. The other way to let us us know about your comments, your questions, your testimonials, or to ask for help and support in the application of these tools is to give us a call at 563-999-3581. And once you call that number, if you press 1 on your phone, it'll put a little icon of a hand by your phone number. I'll turn on your microphone and announce you by your area code. So, we have plenty of time for comments or questions today. Today's a Monday. I usually leave it open a little bit longer on a Monday before jumping into comments and questions to see if something that's happened over the weekend or something that we covered throughout last week has generated comments or questions from anyone listening. And if you have any of those, please press 1 on your phone after dialing 563-999-3581. The kinds of things that generate questions these days usually come from the more recent monologues or discussions that we've had on the show. And this year we're working through the Course in Miracles. Last year we worked through the Course in Miracles, and this year we're working through the Way of Mastery in a rather methodical, some would say painfully slow, process. And the reason for that is my experience with these tools is that, or with this book and these three books in one called The Way of Mastery, and the three books are titled The Way of the Heart, The Way of Transformation, and The Way of Knowing. And my experience of working with this is that they provide actual tools that anyone can use to start to observe for themselves where their family and or cultural conditioning might have been off the mark, where they might begin to look in their own practice for a different way to experience their life, a different way to question fundamental beliefs that they've been operating under because that's what they were taught. And they were taught that by their friends, their family, their teachers, their culture, the language. And this book challenges some of those fundamental beliefs and offers us ways to start questioning through observation and direct application within our own lives certain practices that might show some of those teachings, some of those beliefs, some of those fundamental assumptions as incorrect. And the first one that they come up with in the first lesson of the first book is you are responsible for everything you've experienced in life. Nothing you experience is caused by anything outside of you. You experience only the effects of your own choice. And of course, it's quick to understand, you know, later on that same page, you know, the way of the heart is not the way of the intellect. So if your intellect tells you, wait a minute, I have all these things in my life I didn't choose and I don't want, this work would call you to cancel that intellectual arguing against this observation and start observing it for yourself and see how, if you change the way you interpret and respond to the events in your life, you experience them differently. So it may not change the event. It may not change the car accident. It may not change the tornado that blows through town. It may not instantly change the numbers in your bank account. And yet, how you choose to interpret and respond to those outside events, seemingly outside events, is everything about how you will experience them. And in the last page of that first lesson, it says, look, your intellect does not know anything except the trivialities that you have shoved into it, like a garbage in a garbage can. Your intellect can never bring the healing of the heart that is the atonement. So why is it there? What's the purpose of the intellect? The intellect is there and can be utilized to argue against the insane perceptions that you're used to. So this is just like when Krishnamurti was talking about, you need to see the false as the false. You need to see the false parading around as the truth. And there are many people who will tell you they know you're a victim and you have rights and you should sue this person and you should attack that person because they disrespected you, etc. And this work and Krishnamurti are saying, look, it is so important to back up, take a breath, get centered within the truth of your own nature, bring your conscious awareness to the fact that we're all connected and we're all the same, and then question every negative thought you have. And when you use your intellect to argue against the insane perceptions that you're used to and you've been programmed into, then you might come to see that perhaps there's a greater good in giving up your insistence on treating your intellect as though it were your God. That's a powerful statement. We have been trained, especially in the Western culture, that I think, therefore I am, and what I think must be true, and when I think in logical, I've got this whole system of logical statements that leads to a conclusion, then I need to fight for that to the death if necessary. And this work says, wait a minute, if there's anything in your intellect that moves you over into hostility or fear or confusion or hurt or bitterness or judgment or resentment or blame or guilt, it's in error. It may seem very, very logical as you go through the arguments, but somewhere, if you back up and look at it, you will find that it's built on a false premise. And as we've talked about over and over in this work, you can have a very, very logical process that seems absolutely certain. And yet, if it's built on false premises, or if there's a false premise woven into it, it can lead you astray in a heartbeat. So how do you see clear of that? Well, you know, one of the good uses for your intellect is to see where the trivialities that it's using and churning, and as Guy Finley talks about, the mechanical level of your consciousness that just keeps doing the same thing over and over again, that David Bohm calls a sustained incoherence, where it leads to pain or fear or sadness or any other negative emotion. Take a breath, step back, assume that there's a flaw in the logic and or an error in one of the basic premises that the logical structure is built on. See the false as the false. Step back and ask to be shown a different way to look at this than your conscious logical mind can show you. Open the pathway to the way of the heart and watch how your life changes. So it's wise to begin at the beginning. The beginning of this pathway is simply this. You remain as your Creator created you to be. You are an infinite focus of consciousness. Your very sense of existence is nothing more than a feedback loop or a feedback mechanism so that you can witness the effects of the choices you're making at all different levels, at the conscious level, at the subconscious level, at the deep, deep depth of your mind that rests right alongside the mind of your Creator. And the second chapter is titled, You Create Your Experience. So they just go even more deeply into this, how you're creating your experience of life. It isn't that you're creating the hurricane or the car accident, and yet you are creating how you experience it. What you decree is for you. And the more you can step into allowance, acceptance, surrender, trusting, the more you start to experience your life events and your internal experience of them differently. The second axiom is, I need do nothing. Because if you needed to do something, you would not be free in that moment. And this work keeps telling you, you remain as you were created to be. You remain free. You're free to choose in each moment how you'll focus your conscious awareness in that moment. And it's the focus of that conscious awareness in each moment that creates your experience of life. And the way they summarize the first two axioms is, I am created as the Creator created me to be. I am free. And nothing sources my experience but me in each moment. Nothing has an effect upon me whatsoever except for that which I choose to allow to affect me. I need do nothing. And they encourage us to start practicing this, to walk around and just notice some simple thing that we do every day and take a breath and say, I'm choosing to do this. I have chosen to be here. I have chosen to be in the parking lot walking toward the grocery store. I have chosen to be in my office speaking into a telephone line to give the monologue for the Mind Shifters radio show. The third lesson talks about, okay, let's build a little bit more specificity into the observation that you create your experience of life. Let's talk about the power of forgiveness, which is the title of the third lesson. And here's a definition for you of forgiveness. It has nothing to do with pardoning someone or letting them off the hook after they have hurt you. To forgive in this work means to choose to release another from the perceptions you have been projecting upon them. It is, therefore, an act of dismantling one's false projections. And as you begin to dismantle your false projections over and over and over again, each time you dismantle your false projections, you take yourself deeper into the purity of your own consciousness. You begin to see how profoundly you have been creating, coloring, and therefore affecting all of your relationships through the simple act of not being aware of the power of projection. Right? The opposite of healing and forgiveness is judgment. And if you understood what happens in your energy system when you judge, you would never judge again. The cells in your body don't process waste, don't take in nutrition, they just don't function when you judge. And every time you judge another negatively, instantly before that, you chose to forget or deny the first two axioms, that you create your experience of life, and nothing outside of you creates that, and nothing has any value for you except what you give to it. And it goes on to talk about how you don't live any ordinary moments. Your life is a miracle unfolding. And how you choose to interpret it and react to it creates your experience of it. Goes on to say, if you have any negative emotion, any kind of tension in your body, you could choose to use that as a signal that something's off in your perception, that something's off in your intellectual processing, and or that you've chosen to value your intellectual processing above what your awakened heart might show you. And so it's suggested that we use those tensions and constrictions and contractions as a wake-up call to turn inside and ask to be shown to dismantle any negative perception, which is the heart of this work with Dr. Michael Rice's Reality Management Worksheet. I need to be able to map out, I need to be willing to map out what I'm doing with my conscious logical mind, with my thoughts that create my emotions and my choices about what to value and my intellectual processes that say in order for me to be happy or safe or sane, this person has to change or that situation has to change, and map that out in the first three steps of the reality management worksheet and then cancel it and do a little private meditation, turn inside and ask to be shown, what's the hidden part of my own mind that's actually creating this upset? I mean, this is getting out there more and more and more. Over the weekend, I listened to a little, an interview, some kind of a story that was being told about these two women who were in a relationship. And something happened. And they were, you know, they had a very good relationship. They'd been together for a long time. It was rooted in respect and affection for each other. And yet, something happened to the car of the first woman that was in the possession of the second woman when it happened. And it wasn't any, it was a blemish. It wasn't, you know, a fender bender accident or a totaling of the car. The car ran perfectly, but there was a blemish on the car. And the first woman could not let go of her upset to the point where it was threatening the relationship. And lo and behold, she found a very good therapist who helped her talk about, okay, so what does it mean to you? And she got in touch with a trauma that happened years before when she was just trying to, you know, be on her own and get through college. And her family had supplied the money for a car. So the very first car she had, which gave her some freedom and allowed her the chance to finish college, et cetera, was her prized possession. And it was a pivotal factor in whether or not she was going to be able to maintain her job and finish college. But she had come out to her family as homosexual, and when she went home for a visit, her father asked her if she had straightened out her, you know, goofy thinking, and she said, well, "Yeah, I'm not conflicted about it at all. I'm homosexual, and I'm perfectly happy with that." And he says, okay, you can be happy with that without your car. And so he took the car away, and it was a major setback for her. And it was a rejection from her family, and it meant all of these things to her that she downloaded. And when she uncovered that that incident that she downloaded all of this emotional hurt and feelings of rejection and thoughts about how she's not safe and she won't be able to make it in the world and she won't be able to finish college, that she invested that, all of that, in this car that she later bought with her own money. And then when this disfiguring of the car happened in her mind, it meant that unless it was completely fixed and completely restored to new, that she was being threatened again. And when she uncovered that and the meaning, and she dismantled that meaning, it didn't matter what happened. It wasn't about her value, her worth, her ability to survive. So when she dismantled the false perception that these little scratches on the car meant that she was being rejected for who she was and she wasn't okay as a homosexual and she was not going to be able to survive in the world, as soon as she dismantled that, nothing changed with the car, and everything changed in the way she experienced her life, herself, her worth, her car, her relationship. So this stuff is getting out there in various ways. And there are a number of different therapies that are starting to tap into this. There's a number of different mindsets that people are exploring when they see examples like this. We are creating our experience of life. And there's a guidance system. And lesson four takes us into the guidance system and says, look, if you quit thinking everything that's important is going to be registered with your five senses, and if it doesn't register directly with this gross, immediate, obvious registering in your five senses, then it's not valuable or it doesn't exist at all. If you learn to turn inside and tap into the still small voice, you'll find that the energy of creation that gave rise to you is still there. And it's possible for you to slow down and tune into it and use it as part of your guidance system. And that's what lesson four is all about. They use the word desire to talk about that energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through you in each moment. And they ask you to slow down multiple times a day and ask yourself, what do I truly want? What do I truly desire? What's trying to be expressed through me in this moment? And understand that your intellectual mind is never going to sort that out, because your intellectual mind can't even begin to comprehend the forces of creation that gave rise to you and the planets and the solar systems. And then it moves on to lesson five and it says, look, let's put all this stuff together and add a little tweaking and add a little focus for you and talk about five keys to the kingdom. Five things that you can start to pay attention to that if you do will probably improve your experience of life exponentially beyond what words can say. And those keys to the kingdom are, first, desire, that energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through you in each moment, intention, your ability to keep your focus on your desire to be aligned with that energy of creation, of your intention to stay focused on what wants to express through you in each moment. What is it I most desire? What am I doing on this planet? What am I committed to? These are questions they suggest that you repeat multiple times throughout the day and just breathe and soften and trust what happens after that. Trust to listen to the energy and the intelligence that will want to speak through you. And the third key is allowance. And it says, allowance is the cultivation of a way of looking at the events of your life as stepping stones to what you want, not as obstacles. You're trained in your life to think of obstacles and competition and threats and defending and judgment and criticism. Allowance is the reverse of that. Allowance is this process of keeping a part of your mind open to scanning for tightness and tension and judgment and resistance, and taking a breath and softening and moving into letting go of that resistance and that judgment. And in that next moment, you're in allowance. You're in acceptance. And then you can see more accurately what's happening in your life. And when you see it more accurately, then you can better decide how to respond. The fourth key is surrender. And surrender means that you know through every fiber of your being that your thoughts about you are not all there is to you. That there is an energy flow, there is a consciousness, there is a creative force that gave rise to you and that's living through your body, that's looking through you, breathing through you, experiencing life through you. And surrender is a stage in which perfect peace is the foundation for even more activity. It's not avoidance. It's not drugging oneself out. It's being present in the moment and surrendering to be taught by life and to keep asking, what's mine to do here? How can I be a blessing to myself and others? How is this moment of life unfolding in, through, as, and around me going to lead to something even better than I could have planned? And then the last key to the kingdom is humility, the remembrance that I didn't create myself. I don't even know when I was created. Something is doing all of this through me. Something is breathing me. Something is beating my heart and digesting my food. And so I don't get credit. I don't get accolades for the things that happen when I'm there. I don't want to take any credit for any of this stuff. I just want to say this is an amazing miracle of life expressing in, through, as, and around me, and I am no different than any other human being, and I have a role to play, and I'm just going to play it. And I'm not going to take any credit. I'm not going to get a big head. I'm not going to think, I did this and I did that. And Lesson 6 has us talking about how love heals all things. And if you understand that love is the creative energy force and that is all there is, and you're defining it that way, and you realize that I'm here, but it's not my thoughts about me that are here. There's this spark of life and creative energy that's here, interacting with all of the other sparks of life and creative energy. Then you start to experience life differently. And you realize that only through staying wide open to your emotions and your feeling do you awaken. You don't run from your feelings. You don't shut them off. You don't judge them as bad or wrong. You own it. You look upon it, and then you let it go. And you ask to be shown how you might use that experience to awaken even further. And then number 7 talks about, what's the one of the biggest, the lesson 7 talks about birthing the mind of Christ. What's the thing that would keep you from stepping into your experience of life more fully? And it is fear. And it is errors in thought and intellect that lead us to generate the belief that we could be other than we were made to be, and that at some level there's an actual danger to us. And the fact of the matter is, Lesson 7, you know, one of the key things in Lesson 7 is the story of the blade of grass and the shadow it cast in some remote mountain. And every time we stop from speaking our truth or stepping into our power or loving someone or life more fully, in the moment before that happens, what happened was we stepped into fear. We created an intellectual pattern and valued it and bought into it that generated fear within us. And the invitation is to just notice your fear and understand that it's in every level false. And then when you experience fear, you won't let it drive your behavior. You won't let it originate your words. And one of the key messages in Lesson 7 is you have a place within you that is the very presence of the love you seek. And Lesson 8 talks about, okay, what are you doing with your thoughts? Because every time you choose a thought, it creates, it has the power of creation in it, and it creates ripples that extend out from you and come back to you. And one of the headings in that lesson is, you are not a victim of the world you see. You are creating the way your creator created. You're choosing thoughts, pouring your mind energy into it, and that has an effect on your world. And then Lesson 9 takes that lesson to another level and says, all events are neutral. And you create the impact upon you in your life by the thoughts you choose about the events that unfold around you. And then Lesson 10 says, okay, let's challenge the Western mind even more. because it really got challenged in lesson 9 when we talked about all events are neutral, because boy, did you hear about that shooting over the weekend? Did you hear about that time years ago when a grade school got shot up by somebody? All events are neutral. My butt, right? This is horrible. So there's a major challenge to the Western mind with Lesson 7 and its title, that all events are neutral. And now, here, another one. The way is easy and without effort. That's Lesson 10. That's the title of Lesson 10. And as we encourage people with this work, as we read, as you listen, just watch for the tension, watch for the upset, watch for the judgment that might arise, and soften and breathe and open to it and open to questioning it at every level, at deeper and deeper levels, because you can't evaluate something if you've judged it and you're rejecting it. You're not even understanding how it might have meaning at different levels than what your literal conscious mind is giving to it when it generates resistance and judgment. And so Lesson 10, where we left off on Friday, said, yet what waits before you is simply this: in the end of all your struggles, in the end of all your doubts, in the end of all of the moments of your unconscious conforming to the mind of the world, there remains the simple choice to be made. The choice to acknowledge the truth that has already set you free. Will you choose to remember that I and my Creator are one? You and your Creator are one, inseparable. It has been that way forever. It was accomplished in the being of Yeshua ben Joseph, who revealed the truth of myself to me and to you, because he loved me. And if he can do it, you can do it. Even in this moment, I accept my destiny to walk this earth awake and at peace, in mastery and peace, not fear. And I begin my ministry now. You are always communicating to the world, to the energy field around you, to the people around you, what you value. It talks about this in earlier lessons. It says, your body-mind energy system is simply a very temporary communication device. Everything you value, everything you pour your mind energy into, everything you speak and do and think is communicating to the world around you what you value. And then it says, for who do you think that you could find that could heal you? Who can you discover that can bring some form of magic to you so that you can overcome your resistance to the truth? It can't happen. You've been given the infinite power to choose the focus of your conscious awareness. And if you choose to believe you're a victim, if you choose to use thoughts that lead to rage and grief and bitterness and resentment and judgment, you can do that forever, on and on and on. And it won't change your true nature as a spark of the divine light, as a part of the flow of creation. The text reads, look high and low, and you will not find anyone who can do that, who can change your mind about what you will value. It says, seek forever, and you will remain a seeker forever. For the truth, capital T truth, is set within you. It's set within your heart, and all of the power under heaven and earth is given unto you to choose what you focus that energy on. It is that power that changes the momentum of the mind. And when you choose to do that, it will heal every wounded perception. In the end of all seeking, you must look into the mirror and decide to be the one who heals yourself. You are the one who decides from infinite freedom how to use the power of your mind in each moment. Therefore, the only question that a seeker of truth really needs asked him or herself is this: would I know conflict or peace? Would I choose to be right or to be happy? Would I see the complete neutrality of all events in this world as wisps of a dream being birthed and passing away? Would I see myself as whole and complete? For as I look upon the world, I have judged myself. And as I look upon myself, I judge the world. This was the simple secret that I once discovered when I walked upon your planet. It was not about achieving some grand mystical state of consciousness. It was not about acquiring great powers that could attract the attention of thousands. It was not even about being able to manifest. Although those powers may indeed often express themselves through the mind as it awakens. So if it wasn't about any of that, what was it about? It was about accepting the truth that is true always and being determined to allow that truth to be the foundation from which you enter and join in each and every moment of your experience. This is stepping back to the page before, and we talked about on Thursday and then reviewed on Friday. Here's an exercise. In each moment, start with this: I'm here, I'm free. Heaven is now, the past is passed away, and I can choose anew. This day I commit myself to achieving the ability to teach only love by sharing only loving thoughts. This day, as I encounter each person, before I think too much, before I speak, I'm going to breathe and turn inward, connect the energy of my awareness, my consciousness, to my source. And as I do that, my eyes will be transformed and I will look out and see a brother or sister, a being of brilliance and light, an extension of the same energy that extends through me. I will not see a stranger. I will see one who walks as I walk, one who feels as I feel, one who longs for things the way I long for things, one who is humbled as I am humbled, one who has prayed for peace as I pray for peace. Then I'll turn inside again, see our true nature, mine and theirs as the same, and extend that peace to them, and by extending it to them, I will receive it. So what's this all about? It's about accepting the truth that is true always and being determined to allow that truth to be the foundation of each moment as I enjoin myself with the flow of creation in each and every moment of my experience. I could say it simply as, I am awake, I am safe, I am at peace. What do I truly want this moment to be for? For as I decree it, so shall it be. The text goes on and says, beloved friends, the way is easy and without effort. You exist to extend your treasure. What's your treasure? Your treasure is your awareness of your connection to your source. Your treasure is the conscious focus of your awareness on your true nature as a part of the creative flow and the miracle of life expressing in, through, as, and around you. And your treasure is that which is laid up in heaven through the decision to remember only your loving thoughts, to extend only your loving thoughts, and to allow your actions to express or to manifest in the world, in the field of time, manifest only the good, the holy, and the beautiful. Never is that freedom taken from you. Never in any circumstance do you lose the innocent freedom to teach only love, to be the presence of peace, to recognize that the world can give you nothing of value just as the world can take nothing of value from you. And each time I read that now, I think about Roger McGowan on death row in Texas in a prison for something he didn't do, who's choosing peace. He's choosing to teach love. He's choosing to read spiritual teachings. He's choosing to write letters to people about what he's learning. He's choosing in some of the most horrific circumstances available for a human being to be living in on this continent to teach only love. He's choosing to recognize what was in this paragraph. The text goes on and says, when a child goes through a shift in awareness, they come to a point in their maturation process, not by struggle, not by conscious intellectual design, not by much processing, and not by any manner of strategies. The child merely, in an instant, looks at the toys she's been playing with and simply transcends them. The parents come home, and the child has taken the toy and put it on the closet shelf. The truck is put away, the doll is put away, and a book is picked up instead. Who made that change? Not anyone outside of that child. When you put aside the negative habit, and we label it negative, as you would perceive it to be, when you've given up placing value in something that no longer serves you, you merely transcend it, and it is done with. It's no big deal. No one does it for you. You simply decide. You pull back the value that you had placed on it. You change where you focus your conscious awareness. You pull back the value you had placed on it, and the objects that were the symbols of what you were valuing merely drop out of your life. In just this way, unenlightenment can be put away as though it were a toy that you have outgrown. By merely looking at all of the effects of unenlightenment and then asking the question, is this what I wish to have continue as my experience? Or am I willing to put the doll on the windowsill and pick up a book instead? How about a book that speaks of life with a capital L? A book that is filled with wisdom? A book that teaches me how to step lightly in the world? A book that teaches me how to be in the world, but not of the world? That book is the depth of your consciousness in which all things are already written. Now, when I read that line, I think about how Michael Rice likes to quote the Course in Miracles, where the Course in Miracles says, do not study the Course. So here I'm holding this book called The Way of Mastery. And, you know, the Course in Miracles has some 1,300 pages. And this book has some 400 pages. Right here it's saying the book they're talking about is not a physical book. It's not something that's been dictated or printed. The book that will take you to the next level is the depth of your consciousness in which all things are already written. Don't study The Way of Mastery. Don't study A Course in Miracles. Michael Rice follows that up with, don't study A Course in Miracles. Learn forgiveness. Do forgiveness. Forgiveness is a word that means the process of dismantling any false perception. And how do I determine if a perception is false? If it leads to a judgment or a constriction or a contraction or a negative emotion. Don't study the way of mastery. Use the exercises that it suggests as you're called to use them. Don't use them compulsively. Don't use them because everybody else is doing it. Don't use them and punish yourself if you don't, and celebrate and throw a party for yourself if you do the exercises for a month, just as you're called to do them from the depth of your consciousness, because that's where the book is, where all things of value are written. And all these guides and suggested practices and exercises from Course in Miracles and Way of Mastery are only there to help you connect with your source, to awaken you to the fact that inside you is the perfect teacher and the perfect guide and the perfect guru. The text reads, "That book is the depth of your consciousness in which all things are already written. And that depth finds its source in your heart. You enter it through forgiveness, through dismantling every false perception, through choosing to withdraw your valuing from those thoughts and judgments that lead to tension and bitterness and hurt, through the process of relinquishing the world, not halting the world, not hating it, not despising it, not stopping the world, I want to get off, but simply withdrawing the value you have placed on it, relinquishing it. And when you do that, you allow your time to serve you in the process of relinquishing what does not serve you any longer. And all of those things that do not serve you any longer only disturb your peace." The next heading is titled, "Commit to Awakening to the Peace That Is Already Within You." The text says, "As you cultivate that practice, you will find that the peace that is already within you, that you've touched 1,000 times in 1,000,000 different ways, it begins to grow more constant, like the rays of the sun beginning to filter through the fog that has settled into the mountain valley, obscuring the clarity of all things. As you do that, your peace descends gently, like a dove descending, as some would say, through the crown of your head, down through the brain, mind, down even into the heart, the abdomen, and through the cells of the body, as long as the body lasts. Gently relinquishing the world rests on your decision to choose to teach only love. Because you have realized that when you do not, the effect that you know immediately is painful, conflicted, and unfulfilling. And you simply don't want that anymore. Here, you've begun to transcend the world that you have made and to reclaim the world that has been made for you. A world that rests in perfect union, in the union of creator and offspring, creator and created. The way is easy and without effort." What value have you ever placed upon the world that has restored you to the peace that you seek? You have mistakenly thought, "Oh, this automobile will do it. No, wait, this relationship will do it. Wait, this career might do it. If only I can take a trip to the far corners of the world, then I will be at peace." And so peace never quite comes. A creator, abiding in enlightenment, knows that all events are neutral, and so neutral that they have no effect except for those who choose to be caught up in illusions. The creator who's awakened merely creates out of devotion to the mystery of that which has created him or her. The mind of an enlightened creator doesn't arise in the morning and say, "Oh man, how can I survive another day in this world?" But an enlightened creator arises and asks a question like, "How this day might I extend the treasure of the good, the holy, and the beautiful? How can I, right where I am, experience these treasures, even within the space and volume of this body? How can I look lovingly upon what my physical eyes show me, so that I discern or extract the good, the holy, and the beautiful, and therefore give them to myself?" The mind of an enlightened creator knows that by themselves they do nothing, but in each moment of decision they can allow the great power and mystery of the energy of life and creation and love to direct their course. They can utilize time to refine their ability to hear only the voice for love, for creation, for extension, for atonement. And moment by moment, breath by breath, day by day, until time is translated into eternity, they continue to choose to teach only love. And that mind rests and reclines in its perfect union with its creator. So that's what we're being called to challenge for ourselves, to try for ourselves, to understand for ourselves. Events will still occur. The world will still be what the world will choose to be. The world will not be aware that you have chosen to be an awakened Christ. And yet, you will experience your life differently, moment to moment, dramatically differently. So, that's our offering for today. Will you choose differently, or will you choose as you have chosen in the past? Will you choose to value the gift of life and breath moving through you, or will you choose to judge and criticize and contract away from that gift? You have the infinite capacity to do so, either way. And as we're told over and over again in this work, the Creator, the other beings of brilliance and light, the other sparks of consciousness that have awakened, they will wait patiently, infinitely for you. No one will come and force you to choose the peace that passes all understanding because it's outside of intellectual processing. You can choose judgment and bitterness and craving and obsession, or you can choose to ask to be shown how to live a life that's blessed beyond measure with each breath. So, that's our first hour for today. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And I'll welcome Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Appreciate you. Welcome to a new week.
Welcome yourself. Thank you so much. Have a great show.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Monday, May the 16th, 2022. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And we'll give Michael just a moment to get dialed in. And I'll just say that someone was using the iPhone app and found a little glitch, so there'll be another change coming in on that. I'd appreciate you all using the app and then seeing if you run into anything that's not working and let me know so we can make changes, whether it's the iPhone or the Android, and get it all totally up to speed. And we do appreciate you. And we have a nice rainy day here this afternoon. Ari is a little bit under the weather with some sinus stuff going on, but she's a remarkable little girl. Glad to have her back today. We will be here today and tomorrow live, but then we're going to be on the road. We're going to leave actually tomorrow night after they pick Aria up and try to get 4 hours under our belt. Michael will be doing the support group for those that are in the Mind Shifters from Saturday. That's going to be tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, and so Michael will be doing that by Zoom, but he'll be doing it on the phone as we're traveling. And so then we'll get another, if we do 4 hours tomorrow night, 5 hours in on Wednesday morning before we meet with Krista in St. Louis, Missouri, and see the grandbabies there for a few hours. And then we'll have another 4 hours to head on over to Kansas City, and we'll be there for the rest of the week as Michael J. is getting married on Saturday. And then we'll, afterwards, on sometime probably Sunday, we'll swing back down to Heartland. And then Monday evening and Tuesday, we'll be driving back to here. So probably Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Monday are going to be pre-recorded shows. I think we're going to put on the Beatitudes where Mark had us called into the show for 4 days. And they had an awesome discussion about the Beatitudes and went through them step by step. So we'll be playing that for the rest of the week, and if y'all hold the space for us. But we will be live tomorrow. And then after that, we'll be doing some pre-recordings because there'll be so much going on. So thank you all so much, and I'm going to welcome Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Delighted and honored that you're here. And looking forward to seeing where the conversation gets steered today. Jean, do we have any hands up?
We do not. Several people on the switchboard, but no hands are up.
Cool. Well, I'm going to move in the direction of looking from another perspective at the importance of having accurate perception. And recognizing that perception is a construct of the mind, that, as I say often, our eyes are not showing us anything outside of us. It's not possible to see with your eyes. You see with your brain. And your brain generates its perception, the images that you see, based on the content resonated into activity by what's happening in the world. So, in essence, perception is a product of a resonance. Resonance says that when two energy fields are in tune or in harmony with each other, there's an exchange of information between them. You're probably familiar with an old saying that says, knowledge is power. And it's true. Knowledge is power. And when you recognize the role that language plays and perception plays in what we call knowledge, it becomes pretty important to be on track with it. I've had many conversations with people over the years, and I look back to the times in this work when I used the word, and it's actually kind of, I'm realizing, is lazy language when we don't accurately define our words, when we're not using a word that that really means what we're wanting to think about. And so when we use lazy language, because perception to a great degree is based on words, you know, go back to Yeshua 2,000 years ago, and he says words are this important. The power of life and death, he says, is in your words. And maybe you could mute Jeannie. I'm hearing the keyboard in the background. So if the power of life and death is in your words, then obviously words, which are representations of frequencies, and I'll go to the opening words in the book of John that we've spoken about before, where it doesn't say in the beginning was the Word and the Word became flesh, but rather says in the beginning was the mind energy and the mind energy became flesh. So the mind energy we engage in literally sets up the state of organization of our physiology through the way that it activates or deactivates genes. You know, they're talking about epigenetics. What's above the gene? The gene, you know, is a blueprint. It's a program. It can't do anything, but it can be drawn out into activity by whatever can resonate it into activity. So if one uses language in a lazy way, and here's a piece that, you know, I've had conversation with so many people, and it's just, you know, like pulling teeth to build the brain cells to get to the point of recognizing the importance of it. And, you know, last year, if you were listening through the reading of the book, every time that I used the word love incorrectly, when I didn't understand the definition of love, and I used love to describe something we do to each other, as opposed to a word that describes the essence of our being. And so you'll recall several times that I corrected myself. And so if I were rewriting the book, I'd be changing that word. You know, if I'm using the word love to talk about how I feel about someone, I'd be correcting that and shifting it into the word cherish. Now I've got accurate language. But I've had conversations with, I don't know, at least six or seven people come to mind who are in huge, no, love, no, it's how I feel, I love you. And it's like, well, I'm offering that's the lazy use of language. Because if you use the word that describes the state of your being to describe how you're feeling towards someone, you're in the lazy category of the use of language. You're not using words accurately. And the perception that comes from the lazy use of words is inaccurate perception. And if knowledge is power, and knowledge reflects in and as perception, it better be accurate information. It better be the accurate use of words, or your perception isn't going to be accurate, which means your knowledge is going to be in error. What you think you know is not going to operate properly. It's not going to fulfill what you wish it to fulfill. So poor quality of perception, you know, if you would say give the perceptual output of the mind a rating on a scale of 1 to 10. So my eyes are attuned to something, light energy comes in and brain cells fire, and I have a level 1 perception about whatever that is. So what would that look like? So, you know, I typically use the idea of an accident. You know, six different people were in a courtroom testifying about an accident. You wonder if any two were at the same accident. Their descriptors are so different. So a person who's in level 1 perception around that accident perhaps has a, let's say, a prejudice against women drivers. And objectively, a man drove through a red light and hit this woman. But the person with the level 1 perception might actually see, and I mean literally what we call seeing, with a prejudice against women drivers, and if there's ever an accident, it has to be the woman whose cause, that man's perceptual construct, even though it didn't happen in the actual world, will show him literally a picture of the woman driving through the light and causing the accident. So when we're living in perception, our perception may be accurate about what's going on in the world of actuality, and it may be inaccurate about what's going on in the world of actuality. the thing that would tell you that you're at a level one out of, on a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of accurate perception would be the level of upset, the level of hostility or fear involved. You can bet in a raging, screaming fit, you're a level one perception, and your perception is not even close to what is the actuality of the situation. As you were to forgive, as you were to remove the interfering energies of hostility or fear, your perception might go up to a 3, a 5, a 7, a 9. And once you get up to a 9, all of a sudden, this is where a person has the aha. It goes, oh, my God, I thought it was this, and here it was something totally different. Knowledge. What we know or think we know to be true changes as perception steps up its accuracy. And if you want to really achieve a state where there is true knowledge, then you've got to have true perception. And true perception means that all of the data that the mind selects to give you information about the actuality that happened in a situation, and we're distinguishing between reality and actuality. Reality is the output of any given individual's mind. Actuality is what actually happened. So when we improve perception, then we can get to the point where all of the information that the mind gives us about the object of attention is true and accurate information. The mind is not interjecting errors. Where there's hostility or fear, the mind is always interjecting errors. But we get to the point where there is no hostility or fear, then there's a much better chance that your perception is going to be a level 7, 8, 9, or 10. And that would be where you experience picture that gives you only true and accurate information about what happened in the world of actuality, although it still is not what happened in the world of actuality. It's the mind's story about it. It's what's resonated in the mind. And if the information is accurate, it's going to be, you know, somebody's got a whole lot better chance of being on track with their knowledge about whatever that particular situation is. And so that's why we're looking at, you know, How well known has this principle been? Well, if you go back to Karl Marx and that whole philosophy, you hear his mentor saying, the way to destroy a culture is to change the meaning of its words. Poorly used language, lazy language, means poor perception. Poor perception means poor knowledge. Poor knowledge means no power here. And that's why oftentimes people will rail and rage against what they think is happening because they're feeling powerless. And when one is feeling powerless, you know, nobody can come into your mind and take your power away. It's just not possible. But if you're feeling powerless, I mean, my offering would be that at birth, everybody was issued the same amount of power. Now, we can do one of two things. We can keep it our power as free, available power, or we can blame someone else. And when we stand in that place of blame, we literally tie the creative energy we've got, our power, up in our brain's image of that person. And when one's tied up all of their power in their minds, you know, they've got the same as any other mind, but once they've tied it up in their brain's image of everybody else in their blame game, then they feel powerless. If you're ever feeling powerless, notice that you've invested your power in blaming someone else for what you've created. And so to start to move out of that and get back to accurate knowledge, accurate information, accurate perception requires moving into a place where one honors truth. And then that impetus, the energy behind perception is keyed to love. You know, when they said to Yeshua, what's most important in this law? And law, again, let's get rid of the lazy language. Law is not the rule of the superior, as kings would have you believe. In the ancient Aramaic, law is simply the way things operate. And so when they ask Yeshua, what's most important in the law of being human? He says, according to the Greeks, he says, you've got to love your neighbor and love yourself, love God. But that's totally and completely inaccurate language. That's not lazy language. That's just plain old-fashioned inaccurate language. In the Aramaic language, and it relates, he used the word rachma, and rachma is the filter, the gateway that love enters human form. So it is involved in love. It's involved in opening the space. But rachma is the filter that must stay open in order to move into accurate perception and in order to be present in your own physiology as the true presence of love. And so he's given us keys. And most people, when they hear about it, they get interested and they become believers. Oh, they just love it. It's so great. Except where they've got inaccurate or hostile or fearful perceptions. And then the truth is they don't want anything to do with it. They'll say, oh, yes, I do. But in truth, they totally ignore, completely ignore. And then they wonder where their power went. They wonder why their knowledge is so flaky and why things aren't working in their world. So all of these things seem to be brought into harmony. And, you know, it's interesting. Many people who want to understand this teaching are kind of like, well, you know, I understand that this is like the core of the search of the philosophers of thousands of years. And it's the most important key to living a human life and having a true human mind. So I've got $5 and 5 minutes. Tell me everything you know. And I want it yesterday, by the way. Don't make me go in and examine everything that's in my mind and ferret out my incorrect assumptions. Don't make me do that work. Let me be lazy. Tell me what I want to know. And then tell me it in a way that I can understand it in 5 minutes or less. Don't make me work for it. And, you know, if you really want the answer of the ages, and I mean, you know, think about it. Thousands of brilliant, millions of brilliant minds have contemplated these things for eons, centuries and centuries. And the average person who's in their hostility and fear state and their lazy use of language says, and I got 5 minutes, tell me all about it. And I really want to understand it in 5 minutes. As opposed to, no, this is going to take a lifetime. When you start turning around 1,000 generations of inaccurate, hostile, and fearful perception, you're talking about a significant piece of work. It's not something that just, you know, one gets knighted with and goes, oh, now I understand all of it. It's a process of opening to, it's kind of a combination of things. On one side, it's a dual process. It is literally cultivating your relationship with active present love. And then at the same time, facing, honestly owning everything based in hostility or fear and working toward its removal, undoing the impact of denial. The impact of denial is that when I deny, and our definition of denial is when I think or speak as though something outside of me is the cause of something moving inside of me, the real cause I have to hide from myself. We call hiding the real cause of what's moving inside of you dissociation. So when I deny, I dissociate from this cause. And usually the causes we dissociate from the most deeply are the ones that hold the most pain. And so the closer one gets to those pained perceptions coming forward for correction, the more bizarre it gets, the more intense the hostility, the rage, the fear, the guilt becomes. And that's why we have a whole series of tools for literally weakening the energy fields that come from stored generational patterns from the past, weakening those and strengthening the energy fields that relate to conscious, active, present love. And having a body-mind unit that experiences you doesn't, every time it thinks of love, think about loving someone, doesn't think about a verb, something they're going to do, but really is there to support you experiencing yourself as active, present love and bringing that presence of love, that state of being forward into a mind, into a body-mind unit that is, well, we can go back to a principle out of the ancient teachings. They talked about the Immaculate Conception. Now, you know, a lot of people think that deal with a woman who'd never had sex but had a baby. And, of course, you got to create something miraculous for that one to happen. But the Immaculate Conception is really about how our minds, when they are free of hostility or fear, are no longer tainted by the past, and we have the ability to produce perception that is accurate, and not only accurate, but fueled purely by active love. And so perception moves into the realm, you know, from degraded perception to accurate perception to enlightened perception. And enlightened means that the power behind our perceptual state is that of human life, that of active present love. There's the ideal place where knowledge is experienced as the most empowering, one of the most empowering processes you can engage in. And so everything has to line up. The physiology needs to be vital. The language needs to be on track. The breath needs to be moving. Rachman needs to be set. We need to know who we are as active present love and be continuously choosing again and again and again and again to function as active love. If there is pain within the system, and most people, when they're in pain, what they want is just give me an anesthetic. You know, it's interesting with alcohol. If you take two molecules of alcohol and take out the water, you've got ether. Now, ether's stuff they saw bones with. Pain is gone. You know, that famous song about alcohol, feeling no pain. And someone who is addicted to alcohol, all it's saying is, I have so much pain in me that I can't stand it. I have to have something to anesthetize myself. Hand that person tools. I mean, I've seen it over and over and over again over the decades. You hand that person who's an alcoholic or a drug addict or an hostility addict, whatever it is that they use as a drug. And gradually, over time, they'll find the drug non-attractive because they experience the true state of being and what that feels like, and then they experience the drug state of being. And it's like, who would want a mind that's impacted by drugs, by alcohol, when we're given this just absolutely awesome device called the human mind that is, I mean, when you recognize the extent of history and the trillions upon trillions of human beings and other beings that have been on the earth down through the ages, that we're given the awesome opportunity to experience ourselves as conscious, active, present love. and to experience those around us and step into creatorship, step into creating a life out of that state. It's pretty awesome. But all those things have to line up underneath it in order to bring about the result. And that's why we have tools for each level, each piece of the puzzle. And so hopefully that will open the space for some conversation. Maybe it'll rattle a few brain cells for some folks. And if you're in the listening audience right now and that resonates a question for you, it would be awesome to hear your voice. And the way you do that, of course, is to push one if you're listening to us on your telephone. If you're not listening on your phone but on one of those stations or you're tuned to, you can do this on the phone too, a station that we're broadcast from but we don't have access to, we can't see you, and you can't talk directly to us. So if you're on one of those and you have something you'd like to share, a question or a thought, if you dial 563-999-3581, you'll be listening to the show, and then if you push 1, that will raise a hand in the control panel, and Jeannie will know that you want to talk to us. So, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
We do. We actually have 2 hands up. So the first one
say hello.
Is 760. This is Ann, I think. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Welcome,
I want to go back to... Hi, thanks. I want to go back to when you were talking about the perception earlier in your monologue.
Yes.
And that's when I put my hand up because, and I'm glad you kept going because I wanted to see, well, is he going to go there anyway? But when you were talking about, you know, the usual thing about 10 people seeing an accident and everybody takes away something different. So I'm realizing that it's the same thing with stories. So I just wanted you to and, you know, talk about that more too. So I think the one of the reasons that Yeshua put gossip in there, Paul or whoever was writing in the scriptures about, you know, gossip is just as bad as any other sin, quote unquote, you know, missing the mark of love, that it's because if we take it from one person and listen to what they say and then we go and repeat it to somebody else, something gets lost in it because now we're adding our own perception of what we just heard. So let alone ever having seen the event, right? Or let alone ever having heard the first conversation between two people, and now it gets imploded. I mean, anyway. But anyway, I wanted you to address that. So because I'm realizing as I go through the way of listening, the way of mastery, it's like, if all events are neutral, then, okay, it is my perception that's putting a value on it. Then I can do that with story, with anything that anybody tells me or I listen to. Okay, I'm complete.
Right. Well, the first thing that comes up is that in exactly the same way, and this is not something I normally get into. It doesn't come up very often, at least as often as the whole idea of what we see. But in the same way that seeing what the world of what we call visual input is done by the mind, that's generated by the mind, so is our listening. The truth is, nobody has ever heard a word anybody else has said because nobody has ever said a word in their lives. It's kind of like Einstein's idea of matter. On such things as matter, we've been all wrong. What we have heretofore called matter is energy. Energy whose vibrations have been so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses. There is no matter. We don't live in a material world. We live in an energetic world. Now you say, I'm listening to your words, Michael, but the truth is your brain is doing the listening, and all I'm doing is causing a little flap of skin to move in my throat that causes a little microphone to move that when it's received on your end causes a speaker to move that causes your eardrum to move, and your brain makes up what you hear. So that's why we have a workshop called Communication. Did you hear what I think I said? Because literally, you know, if you've got an audience of 100 people – and just have a two-minute event and then get everybody to stand up and describe what happened, there'll be no two who will say exactly the same things, because each brain generates the world we hear as much as it generates the world we think we see. And so it's the world we think we hear. And so recognizing that, it becomes important, again, to, especially in the arena of words and language, to be accurate. So at least there's some standard by which we can move in the direction of agreement on what our minds are feeding us. So that old, you know, parlor game where somebody whispers into somebody's ear, who whispers, well, you know, if I whisper words in your ear, or I make that little flap of skin vibrate close to your ear, your brain cells will interpret and feed you a meaning. And then when you feed that meaning to the next person, their brain cells will feed them a meaning, who, and on it goes. And so, you know, by the time it's gone through 10 people, you wouldn't recognize we're talking about the same thing. And that's why, because it's the brain that generates what we hear. It's not the words that another person says.
Yes, yes. And thanks for the reminder. Yes, absolutely, because I've gone through that in the laws of living. And yeah, but that's a great reminder. And I've heard it, you know, over the course even of, you know, Dr. Tim has talked about it too. And it's like, okay, but I don't know if the word indoctrinated, I guess, yeah, society, or we're told or we're taught by our environment or our parents coming up that, you know, words are words and this is what it means and you get all your feelings from it and yada, yada. But now, and I did go to another seminar that a gentleman here in Gainesville, actually out of Gainesville, and he talked
right.
about that, and he drew a like little artsy thing of it, where the line came from the one person's mouth and went to the other person's ear. And so it was talking about that. So that is what comes to mind again. I go, oh, okay. Absolutely. The frequency. Okay. Thank you.
And then the brain cells that interpret.
Yeah.
So, cool. Good to refine the understanding.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Any other thoughts for you today?
Nope. That's good. I'm enjoying.
Well, you have an awesome day. All right. Thank you.
You too. Thanks.
Bye. So, Michini, you've got another hand up?
I do, and I believe it's Miss Susan, 610. You're on the air.
Hey. Hi, everybody.
Well, welcome, young lady.
Well,
how are you?
Thanks. You've got an interesting itinerary coming up. My goodness.
It is. We're looking forward to it.
And a marriage. So great.
Yes.
So, I spent the week giving up goals, pretty much. Doing my own work and
a lot of canceling, eh?
Yeah, I didn't get Jacob on the radio show once. He was listening, I thought, to part of Dr. Tim because we were together in the kitchen and I had the speaker on. But
right.
as soon as his lunch was ready, he just went right upstairs to his room where he spent most of his time. So the only times I had with him, he came downstairs a couple of times in the evening. He had some rehearsals. He had some activities outside, but he wasn't interested in visiting until he had had a couple of drinks. And I know you were talking about addiction, and I'm listening with the biggest possible ears. He had a couple of drinks and he offered me a bong, some weed. And I said, Jacob, I would love to. I'd like to go there with you. I'd like to experience that and have my mind opened up in ways it probably never has. But I feel as if I've got such a delicate balance here in my mental health that I just don't dare. And he said, yeah, I get it. I do. So I said, but I'll go outside with you if you want to smoke. He doesn't smoke in the house. So we
right.
sat outside and he talked. He would talk about his life and his father and his fears and so forth. But there wasn't really any way that I could hook in and even offer a worksheet. The only
right.
thing we talked about, there were two things. He understands what a power person is. And he said you by name. He said, you know, one thing you told me Michael Rice said is that if you take the victim position, you're just not going to ever get anywhere. You cannot play the victim. And I thought, whoa, that's big. And I said, congratulations
that's
for
big.
Remembering that. So, and he's moving forward. It's just, that's where the goal canceling comes, is it's just going much, much more slowly and strangely than I thought. And I say strangely because his youngest brother, who has had the best attention from his father, he was with his father all week, and I didn't hear a peep out of him. And I know why, because his father would be on his case if he knew that he was using father and son time, their part of the divorce agreement, to come over and see the other grandmother, or any grandmother for that matter. So suddenly on Friday night, when the clock ticks over to the other side, Max, the young one, could come over to my daughter's house. He walks in.
Right.
He's so articulate, and he told me about what's happening now. He said, now that I'm the only one in my father's house, I am getting what my older brothers got. And I saw it happening, but I never got it, and now I'm getting it. And he said, I'm older, and I understand some things, but I am so trapped, and I have one more year of school where this arrangement has to stay in place.
Right.
And I know I could choose to leave, but my father is brilliant in his game playing, and he's so mentally ill. We will go on for maybe 6 months. It's been the best. 6 months, and we're getting along fine, and I love him, and I love his company. And then suddenly something will start to give, and he'll start little barbs, little guilt trips. And he'll start asking me to spend more and more time with him. And I'm in school, and I'm in a show, and I'm so busy, I need to study. And I'll explain to my dad, but he guilt trips me. And then it gets so bad that we have this huge blowout. And he told me about one where he ended up staying in his car all night. They had gone to look at colleges, and his father got mad at him for saying something. And he was so terrified to go back to the room that he spent most of the night freezing in the car and finally crept into the hotel room when he hoped his father would be asleep. His father wasn't, but didn't say anything, just gave him the cold shoulder. Terrorizing, terrorizing. But he says, because of that, it isn't worth it to me to decide to live only with my mother. It'll be too awful. I've got to ride this out. And I know how to talk to him most of the time. Most of the time I can manage, but it is exhausting. He said, I'm exhausted, and I've had two true panic attacks. I've never had a panic attack, Michael. I thought I had, but I've had an anxiety attack. He said, out of the blue, my hands and feet started going numb. I felt lightheaded. I must have thrown up 12 times in total terror, but I didn't know what I was afraid of. And oddly enough, my father saw this happening and was wonderful to me. He's the only person I really feel as if I could get that sick in front of. He took such good care of me. And so it's such a paradox. This is a 17-year-old boy talking to me this way.
Wow.
So articulate. And then he starts talking to me about Jacob. He said, how's it been going? And I said, well, it really isn't going because, I mean, I'm cleaning up the house. I cleaned up the fridge. I cleaned the freezer, the pantry, did a lot of laundry. I'm loving being here. And I've met some of my daughter's friends who took me out to lunch, and that was just such a thrill. But Jacob has disappeared into his room, which he always did, and you and I talked about that. Said, well, when I come over here, though, I'm not safe here because Max becomes just like my father. So So there you have it. Max's well-being, childhood well-being, is such an issue for Jacob that Jacob hates him. He feels hatred for him, and he mistreats him. So Max feels as if he just has nowhere he can go that's safe. So he says, I love school. I feel safe at school. I'm going on a trip to Israel with my class, and I'm looking forward to it because it's 10 days away from my dad and away from Jacob. So Jacob's, and he's not conscious because I got a chance to talk to Jacob about this. And Jacob said, I said, you know, Max really needs an older brother who's caring of him and listening to him, his companion. Jake says, I'd do that. And I said, I hear other reports. He said, like what? And I said, well, you go into his room at night, even when he's trying to sleep. You crawl into his bed. And you do weird things, not sexual things, but he started licking him one night. And Max says, Jacob has this weird, creepy side that I never saw before. And I don't know what to make of it. And I say, get out of my bed. Don't do this. Go sit in the chair. I'll talk to you. But you're not in my bed like this. And Jacob says, I didn't do that. And I think Jacob's telling me the truth. I think Jacob is going unconscious sometimes. So, Michael, you can tell I'm really, really concerned about these kids, and I'm constantly letting go of the goal of having a couple of older grandsons there. So that's the report, and thanks for listening. And I know we were going to talk about that, and here it is on the show.
Yeah. And are you able to process? It sounds like Max is quite conscious. Are you able to process with him?
So he's
able to get a leg up on it then.
He thinks he's got a great therapist, and he's now on Lexapro, which is a beta blocker, he said, and it'll help him not have one of those panic attacks again. He said, I don't want to stay on this. I want to understand what's going on, but I cannot go through another one of those. So I thought, well, there's probably the right use of a drug. He's never smoked, he's never drunk, he's never had weed, and he's not going to. He sees what happened to his brothers, and he's not going to go there. But, you know, he's suffering. His grades have fallen a bit, and he's under a lot of stress. So,
well,
I'd love to process
the highest,
with him. I'm not, yeah, go ahead.
The highest piece of information I think you could give him, and, you know, that kind of checking out thing, the numbness and all, would be ultra stress, would be to have him understand that the way stress is created is by holding goals, and that he can just, you know, without getting into the whole worksheet or the whole forgiveness process, just look on a daily basis, you know, at night before you go to bed, and can't just cancel all your goals, and you know, and then in the morning, you set the goals that you're going to use for the day, but don't set any more than you can handle for the day, so you keep your stress at manageable levels. And that might be an opening, the starting point for him to, I didn't know. I thought situations cause stress. You know, you listen to our culture and they talk all the time about, well, that stressful situation. Well, no, there's no such thing as a stressful situation. But there are situations where all kinds of goals come up for me and I'm ultra stressed. If I know that and I can remove those goals, then I can be in that situation and not experience the results of being ultra stressed.
That's great.
So I would think that would be one piece you could give him. Yeah.
Okay,
Sounds like a bright
That's
young
very
man.
Helpful. Very bright, emotionally very intelligent. He is having to be the parent of his father. Now, his father has had about, talk about Dr. Sarno, his father has had probably 6 back operations, neck and back operations for his age. And he's in the hospital right now with a spinal fusion in his lower back, and he's turning 60, and he's making his son into a parent. He cries in front of him, says he's going to end up alone. Nobody stays with him. He doesn't seem to understand why. He doesn't seem to know that he does stuff. And yet, in other ways, he's the most brilliant man. So... and here we are up here. But Max says, you know, when I get out of high school, I'm heading out. I'm going to go to college far away.
Yep.
That'll be my freedom, says. So that's a great idea, though, Michael. I wrote it down.
It also sounds like Jacob is really taking on Dad's role of the trauma inducer. Like, he's playing the power person with Max.
Yeah, he is.
And I don't know if there's room for him. You know, you say that Jacob understands the power person dynamic, then maybe there'd be space to let him know that he's just playing out what Dad played with him. He's playing out with Max.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time for a change. It's time to honor your brother in a different way and give you both of you some relief rather than just playing that out.
Yeah. I did have a couple of short talks with him along those lines, and I may have access again because he's decided he's going to a summer theater program in New York City, and he's going to use us as a stop, and he may even be here by next week for a week or two. So I'm really
awesome.
You know, I'm setting up more goals, goals to be here for him, go for walks, you know. Anyway, that's
any chance of just getting with him and breathing him? You know, if he comes
well, you
to
know
visit,
how
just,
I
you know.
Think at that.
Well, but you don't have to be the one breathing, but you could guide him in doing it. You could take that energy field work and, you know, assist in energetically in him just, I mean, if the young man could learn to breathe, if you can't get to him cognitively, just the trauma that he'll be able to process just by breathing will be monumental.
Okay, I'm taking notes.
And, you know, you might... when you know when he comes to visit, might put forward the thought of, you know, I've been learning this thing called energy field work, and I don't have too many places to practice it. Would you let me practice it on you? You know, you've got the diagrams and the energy field worksheets, and maybe practice it with him. And as you're practicing, it's like, I notice you're not breathing. Why don't you breathe a little bit? Breathe with me while I do this. It'll help to open up what I'm learning. And who knows what might crack open if you give him that gift.
Yeah, well, you'd never know, because that remark about being a victim, he's really running with it. So he's not blaming his father anymore. He's just becoming him every once in a while, and he's still hiding out in his room. But he's not processing, really. He's just reacting.
Right.
So, but on another level, he's very functional. He was in a concert last night. He learned the music at the last minute and did a beautiful job. And so when he puts his mind to it, he seems there. So anyway.
Well, you know, that old thing of life without tools. And so just every opportunity that you can sneak in a tool, that he's got something to work with, and things will move upward for him. That's the space I would hold for both of them.
Great.
And
so
how's
Matt,
your daughter doing?
Very available. Well, she finished the Bishop walkabout, and the conclusion, they'll be voting this week, and by Saturday she'll know whether she's going to be the next Bishop of Connecticut. She did beautifully. They had these long Zoom. I mean, I must have watched 10 hours of interviews. I was watching.
Really? Wow.
And the candidates are all very impressive. I think my daughter has the widest spectrum of gifts. She's not only a priest and a pastor and an excellent preacher, but she's savvy about inner city development, using the wealth of the church to redistribute, make amends, you know, go into the inner cities and share the wealth
right.
in the inner city churches. She's like,
sweet.
She has a staff of 25 people, and that's what the Diocese of Connecticut has. the diocese has 25 people on their staff. And she said, I already know how to manage the staff. She really blew her own horn in the most wonderful way. She just said, this is what I can do.
That's awesome.
I'd be a good bishop for you. She wasn't self, she wasn't embarrassed, but she wasn't gross about it either. She was just perfect. She's done so many things
right.
I don't do very well, and I was proud of her. So whether she gets it
Sweet.
Or not, it's just she did a great job. So thanks, yeah.
Nice.
And she was
and
glad
I see
I
she's getting married.
Yeah, she is. A boyfriend from high school contacted her as soon as she announced her divorce and said, I'd love to talk. And she said, sure. Next thing you know, they've fallen in love. I know you don't believe in it, but it happened.
A sweet reunion. Awesome.
Yeah. I know.
Sweet. That's awesome.
He's wonderful. And he was with her the whole time, during every interview. They had to go virtual at the last minute because one of the spouses got COVID. And they couldn't do the physical
right.
visits to all the towns. So they went
all
virtual,
right.
and they went right back to his house in Hartford, and they did the whole thing out of his house. He set up a little studio for her, so she looked very professional. Very cute.
Nice. What great support.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I know. It is. It's totally wonderful. So a lot of happy stuff. But the work I must have done, eight. I've been doing more than five most days. So they're just sort of like ongoing. It's a way of approaching anything, any twinge and I'm into a worksheet. So good tool.
And what output are you seeing? And I'm asking you to share that so that others get a taste of what it is to pick up and commit to doing five worksheets a day.
Well, it becomes a new way of organizing thoughts, number one. It becomes a way of becoming conscious of a bad feeling before you would have been otherwise. I can go around for half a day sort of off kilter and not even look at it. And now as soon as there's a twinge, I say, uh-oh, time for a worksheet. What's this one about? And as a result of doing them, a lot of memories have come up that I hadn't remembered before. A striking thing, and it's probably pretty common, is that most issues go right back to a few basic situations in childhood, but always from different angles. It's like it's fleshing out the whole thing. What else can I say?
Well, the thought that occurs,
goals. Yeah.
Right. Well, Paul talks about be transformed by the renewing of your mind, and it sounds like you're just constantly in that renewal state, and that's awesome. That's powerful.
I did spend a lot of time in Florida feeling anxious and doing worksheets. I said, here I am in this beautiful place. I've got a grandson holding up in his room upstairs. Why am I so anxious? Giving up goals of having Jacob come downstairs, of having him talk. I never said a word about the drinking. He came home and said his psychiatrist said that he should cut down to two glasses of wine max a night. And I was surprised that it was that lenient, but I said, do you think you can do that? And he said, I'm going to try. I don't know if I can, but I'm going to try. So I said, that's great. So he doesn't think of me as a judgmental parent who's he tells me when he's drinking and he tells me when he's smoking.
Right.
So that's good, I guess.
Now, didn't you guys have an agreement at one point where you gave up sugar and he was giving that stuff up?
Yes, and I've still given up my sugar because I feel so different when I'm on it and not. But he hasn't honored his end of it. And I said to him, I'm honoring my side. So that's all I can do.
Did you have any conversations
with
inviting him to be, ask him to be in integrity with his word? And that can be done gently and respectfully and even playfully.
Good. I'm glad you added that. Yeah.
It's like, come on now, you gave me your word and I'm sticking to it and I'm going to control you. I'm going to bug you until you do too. Like, stop it. You said
okay.
You were stopping it. I did. Let's get on this. And, you could do it playfully and laugh at it, have fun with it instead of being judgmental about it, and, you know, maybe share some of the benefits you're experiencing from giving up your drug, and invite him to share some of the benefits he's experiencing.
Good idea.
And you know, and also I think a really deeply heartfelt statement of why you want that for him, what you want for him. You know, oftentimes when the mind is, you know, boggled by drugs and alcohol, the capacity for vision is gone. And, you know, you might be able to hold a vision for his life that allows him to reconnect. You know, one of the things I've been studying and reading about a little bit lately is newborns and co-sleeping. And one of the things they've discovered with newborns is that when a newborn sleeps alone, they sometimes forget how to breathe or how to keep their heart in rhythm. It's like it's not a habit yet. And that one of the benefits of co-sleeping, of sleeping with a parent, is the energetic rhythm of the mother's heart. Literally, the baby's heart entrains, the breath entrains, so that, you know, that habit is developed physiologically. And so, you know, who knows what the possibilities are.
God, that's gorgeous, and I feel very sad about the fact that so many of us babies, when we were babies, didn't do that. You know, too bad.
It's crazy. There's a video, actually, Jeannie and I just watched it a couple of nights ago, and it's available on, you can rent it for $3 on YouTube. If you're on Amazon Prime, you can watch it on Amazon Prime. Oh. And it's called The Milky Way.
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting. It started out, I didn't know how the Milky Way became named the Milky Way. But actually it was, and I'm not sure the Greek characters, but you know, it was Zeus and his wife, and Zeus had an affair or something. Now, I may not have the gods' names correctly, but whichever god it was, had an affair, had a baby, and brought the baby home and put it on his wife's breast while she was sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
And she woke up and was so upset, she tore the child away, and the spray from her breast sprayed out and became the Milky Way, all the stars in the Milky Way. Which
wow,
I thought was kind of an interesting little, I wasn't aware of that piece of, you know, history. But it goes from there to the importance of breastfeeding a child and the insanity that's happened, the profit motive that's come in for medicine, for the manufacturers of formula and such. And one of the things that that they brought up in it was one of the Fox channels did some research on SIDS in cases where a child died while sleeping in bed with a parent. And they put up during the film, was it because the parents were drinking? Was it because they were sleeping on the couch? Was it because the baby had formula? Was it because, you know, some other factor?
Yeah.
The common link in every child that they researched that had died was they were on infant formula.
I'm not surprised.
So it just ties together a whole lot of things, and the importance of, you know, the craziness that happened back in the 50s and 60s when, you know, these doctors came out with their pronouncements about, well, you know, formula is better and blah, 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 and the whole thing about, you know, as a culture, honoring women instead of sexualizing breasts, to honor women and honor babies and bring them into our culture and bring them into our, you know, our lives, our workplaces and everything else, instead of there being a stigma attached to something as simple as breastfeeding. But it's a powerful video.
Wow.
The Milky Way. All right, young lady. Well, we're at the last minute, so I appreciate you, cherish you, and we're here to hold the space. And everybody have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.